Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 and goes out every Friday afternoon at 2 o'clock on BCFM 93.2. Dialect is produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square. Dialect recommends the volunteer-run Bristol Bully Watch Helpline, aimed mainly at school children and parents. The number is 01454 318 753, and we'll have a reminder of phone numbers for Volunteering Bristol and Bully Watch at the end of the show. And I'm joined this week, to begin with, by Jackson Moulding from Ecomotive. Hi, Jackson. Welcome to Dialect.
Hello, Tony.
Now, first of all, what is Ecomotive, Jackson?
Ecomotive is a workers' cooperative. We're based in Bristol, and with the aim of the organisation is to try and support more self-build, group self-build projects happen across the southwest and further afield.
Now, but although you're Bristol-based, you're not just involved in local stuff, are you? You're part of a national self-build group.
Yeah, so I'm also the vice chair of the National Self-Build Association, which has been working, I guess, as a lobbying entity, working with central government, trying to raise the game of self-build and trying to increase the opportunities and trying to address some of the hurdles that are sort of preventing group projects or even more individual projects happening.
Now, it's one of the countries in the world where probably less self-build goes on than anywhere else on the planet. I mean, it's certainly the norm here is for people to buy one of these kind of jelly mould houses. I don't mean that rudely, but, you know, one that's kind of exactly the same as like 100 others in the same street. The idea of self-build is not really never caught on, certainly for the last probably 150 years or something in Britain. Why is that?
Well, it's an interesting question, isn't it? How have we got into this situation? You know, there's a lot of houses which are created by the developers, and there's a kind of sense that's a feeling that the developers work in a way where they produce in these houses. There aren't that many other options, so that's what people have to buy, and so that's considered as though that's what people want. So the housing delivery in the UK has been predominantly by developers, and that's what people have got used to. That I think that there is a sense of, you know, as children we mess around making dens, and somehow that has got lost along the way, and the feeling that self-build is something that anyone can do has kind of been taken away from us in
it
the
has.
UK.
I mean my parents spend half the year in New Zealand, and over there it's just completely normal for people to actually design, not actually to necessarily build their own home, but to be involved in the whole design process, because I suppose maybe it's just to do with land, that here the land is much more expensive, it's much more scarcity. You have to pay a lot more for the land compared to other places on the planet. I know, you know, quite often if you're buying a house, although it's a hidden cost in buying that house, probably, you know, up to three quarters of the value of that building can just be the land underneath it. And that means that, you know, it's not necessarily going to be very easy for someone to buy the land and then build something on it.
Yeah, getting hold of land is one of the biggest hurdles that people have got. You know, there's getting hold of the land, there's obtaining the finance to do a project when you've got the land. And because of the difficulty in getting hold of the land, I think that is preventing groups, particularly groups doing projects, but even individuals that trying to find a spot that
it's also
within their budget.
Difficult, isn't it, to actually get permission to build? I mean, you know, I keep seeing in newspapers pictures where people built a house and then they're told, no, you've got to knock it down. Obviously, there's a bit of a disincentive to build your own house if you're going to find it impossible to get planning permission and go through those hoops, because the planning permission system, to most people, I mean, it seems that you're not allowed to do anything unless you've got some kind of army of planners prepared to fill in 1,000 forms a minute, you know, to get you your planning permission.
There is a bit of a chicken and the egg, because if you want to buy a site, if you want to borrow money to buy a site, then to borrow money you generally have to have planning permission for the lender to feel secure that they're providing money to something that's going to happen. So you potentially have to do a huge amount of work before you get planning, and so there's a great big risk there for someone to go through that process.
But the proof of the pudding's in the eating, isn't it? And you've actually been involved in building your own place, I understand. Can you talk about that and where you live?
Yeah, so I'm part of the Ashley Vale Self-Build Project in in Bristol that I'm sure lots of people know about.
Well, not necessarily, Jackson, because it's kind of cut off, isn't it? It's under that tunnel in St. Werburgh's at the other end of Minor Road that unless you're actually meaning to go there, you're not going to go past it on the way to anywhere because it's a little cul-de-sac, isn't it?
It is. But if anyone's on the train heading north out of Bristol, then if you look down to the left as you once you've gone past Stapleton Road, then you know if you look out for some sort of strange shaped houses after you go through the embankment, then you know that's the self-built site.
Okay, so how did you get involved in that? How did that all come about?
Well, I was living in the area. I was renting a room off of a friend, and I couldn't afford to get a house in Bristol. But I was wanting to get a place because obviously you know I wanted to set up a family and you know all the things, you know, there's this sort of inbuilt desire to have a place of your own, but I just couldn't afford it, and this site came available. The local community got together, people living in existing houses around the site got together and went, how can we take on this site? You know, there's a developer that was interested in the site. It was an old scaffolding site covered in concrete, a few warehouses, an old 1960s office building.
So it's a kind of scaffolding firm that moved out, went bust or something?
Yeah, they didn't go bust, they moved out, they decided the site wasn't for them anymore. And it was, you know, a bit of prime real estate, not too far from the city centre in Bristol, but a very interesting spot, surrounded by allotments. There's a sort of farm down there.
You couldn't get more allotments, I don't think. How are those allotments, by the way? There doesn't seem to be many free, amazingly. There's loads of allotments there, aren't there?
Yeah, they're really beautiful allotments. There's a lot of usage of them, and especially when the sun's out, there's lots of people up on there digging and planting onions and stuff.
Anyway, so I think you've given us pretty much your self-build credentials. How did you find it building your own place? Was it how you expected?
It was great. It was like, you know, we didn't set out to go right, let's bang it out in 6 months. It wasn't grand designs. It was a project where let's create a home that's going to be ours and we could afford to do. So, you know, it took some time. It took about 5 years to do. We were doing it in evenings and weekends when there's a bit of space to kind of get involved, then that's what we did. So
what have you got in your house that you wouldn't necessarily have if you just moved into a bog standard terrace, you know, somewhere else or somewhere nearby in the city?
Okay, so the local houses nearby, sort of small Victorian terrace units, or 2/3 bed homes. Our house, we've got, it's larger, I guess. It's got it's timber frame house. It's got loads of recycled newspaper in the walls as insulation. We've got solar panels and we've got underfloor heating. We've designed it slightly. You know, there's rather than a square door going from one space to another space, we've got a big round circle, and yeah, it's, you kind of put your own flavour into it. And I think that's the beauty of doing a self-build is whatever it is that meets your own desires, you can apply that. And
now, for a lot of people, Jackson, building from scratch, doing all the foundations, would be an absolute nightmare. I know there's another thing, which is a sort of halfway house called self-finishing. That seems to me to be a bit more of a runner. You know, the idea of digging foundations, I wouldn't necessarily know what I was doing. But, I mean, this may be, are there examples of that in the city?
Yeah, well, the self-finish, or there's a new term that the government brought out a while back called custom build. And the idea is that, you know, not everyone wants to build their own house completely, and not everyone does. You know, it's actually a very small percentage of people actually build their homes entirely themselves. Actually, last year, there was about 12,000 people did a self-build, which is amazing. But the ability to get other people in, get local workforces in, I think on average, there's 7 jobs created on every self-build project and about £50,000 to £100,000 worth of purchasing and local materials for every self-build. You know, if someone wants to get involved, do their own project, it's about influencing the design, influencing what you want out of it. And then you can make that choice of to what extent you want to be involved in the build. You know, you might be just to get local contractors to do most of it for you.
Okay, so actually the self-build thing really is more, well, at least as much about the design of it, you know, and actually the management, being your own developer. I mean, it's a bit of an awesome task. I wonder if maybe, you know, in Britain here, because we were the first country in the world to go for mass urbanisation, and we've kind of got used to the fact that we don't build houses here in Britain, that they're all built for us. I mean, there was the massive council house building programmes pre-war, and after the war, you know, literally millions of council houses being built, and so we had no real shortage of housing. And I wonder, with the situation today where we have got a massive shortage of housing, maybe, you know, your industry could be on the up.
Well, I'd like to think so. I think that there certainly it is a route that, you know, for instance, if you had the opportunity for people to come along to take on a plot that was provided to them at a kind of affordable rate and allowed people to create a home that met their own budget, you could, you know, if someone came along with £40,000 or £50,000, you know, create a home that costs £40,000 or £50,000. Someone comes along with 250 or half a million, and they can create a home that costs that much. And the beauty about self-build is that you can allow people to can come in and they can create their own spaces. And I think that that is an avenue that we can sort of bypass some of the normal routes that housing has created.
Well, certainly, I mean, Ashley Vale, you've got an amazing selection of different places. I mean, no two alike. Well, maybe a little bit alike, but I mean, really incredible design. And also the idea that you're living in a place that you've made yourself. I mean, for many of us, this doesn't come into our radar at all.
No, and you know, if you know, there's lots of people who have visited the site, it doesn't mean that, you know, not everyone likes everything that's been created there. And you look around and some bits you go, wow, that's really amazing.
It's a bit of a planning nightmare. I mean, the planners try and fit one set of buildings or one building in with another building and make it look nice. And, you know, apart from, of course, when they built IKEA right next to a whole load of terraced houses in Eastville there. Anyway, that was an aberration. But, I mean, most of the time the planners are trying to make one house fit with another. And I guess somewhere, you know, like Ashley Vale, that's almost impossible. And I wonder, you know, what the other another question, if I can ask you about three at once, is do you have open days there, or can people just wander around?
Yeah, well, people can come and wander around. We are actually having, as part of the National Self Build Week, a tour, and we can go into that in a moment.
Yeah, do.
But the in terms of planning, I think it is it's something that the planners want. Can be and have been generally in the past trying to make things risk-free. So if you can, if someone puts in a planning application for a house that looks like all the other houses, then it's much easier for the rest of the community to accept that house is going to be present there. So if someone puts in a design which is very different, very contemporary, looks very different, then, you know, then there is a question there, you know, who says that, you know, what you like, what I like, what anyone likes is very subjective. So generally planners try to make things look the same as what's already there. However, you know, I think there's a change in the air. I think there's people are recognizing that we need to build differently if we're going to meet some of our sustainability targets. You know, if we're trying to make houses more energy efficient, we want to make houses, you know, incorporate passive design, you know, changing where the windows are.
Yeah, passive design, that's where you're building it to face the sun, is it?
Well, making it so you can capture the sort of sun's energy during the winter and
it's a lot less to heat. I mean, I've been into some of these places. Now, you're involved and I'm involved. I mean, this is a bit of an incestuous chit-chat, really, but we're both involved in the Community Land Trust. Can you just tell us a little bit about Eastville Park, what's planned there and how far it's got?
Yeah, so the Bristol Community Land Trust is developing a site just on the edge of the park, which is it's an old school building, and there's a little bit of sort of brownfield site there. And the Bristol Community Land Trust, the BCLT, has just put a planning application in last week, so that's very exciting. And
what's the idea? I mean, how many houses, eco style houses, are going to be built there?
So the idea is there's going to be six new buildings, and which will be three bed, and there will be six single bed units. Some of them will be rented, some will be sold shared equity. And the idea, as it's part of the Bristol Community Land Trust, is making the houses more financially accessible for people to be involved in, and that they'll remain affordable for the long term. And so the idea at the moment is trying to get the houses so they're about 66% of the market value in terms of what someone would have to pay to get involved.
Well, yeah, you better get on the queue and in the list if quick as possible. Yeah. Because they're nice places, aren't they?
They're beautiful places, yeah. I think it's going to be a really exciting project.
Okay, finally, this self-build week, what's happening? You mentioned a tour of, maybe that's the best place to start.
Yeah, well, there's lots happening on National Self-Build Week. So that National Self-Build Week runs from the 4th to the 12th of May. It's the first self-build week there has been, so it's a new thing. It's run partly through the National Self-Build Association and Grand Designs. The heart of probably most of the activities will be at Excel in London. There's a number of people. There's Kevin MacLeod, obviously, is going to be there. We're going to have the Right Honourable Mark Prisk, who's the Housing Minister. He'll be opening the big debate on the first day, Saturday, 4th of May. And there'll be a discussion around self-build and how ordinary people can benefit. There's also on Tuesday, 7th of May, Nick Bowles, the Minister for Planning, is going to be talking about, you know, making sense of planning and what that means for the self-build sector. And also some other exciting things. There's on actually the Sunday, the 5th, there's going to be the launch of the self-build on a shoestring competition, which is more details to follow on that. But that's Kevin McLeod will be one of the judges of that. And then on the Monday, the 6th, we are going to be launching the community-led housing guide for local authorities, so local authorities can try and find a route through this and find a way of actually making self-build more accessible for people in their own area. In Bristol, there's a couple of things happening. One is we're running a tour on the Ashleyville self-build project, so if anyone's interested in coming along, they can book. There's limited number of places, but you can book at ecomotive.org and put your name
well,
down.
Well, better have something other than just internet. What about a phone number? Any phone number?
I can give you a phone number, yeah. It's Bristol, so it's 0117 924 1263. And people come along. We'll be looking around the site. We'll be hopefully popping into a couple of houses and talking about how it developed and what people can take from there. And the second really good thing that's happening in Bristol is that the Bristol Community Land Trust is having an open day again on the same day, which is the 11th of May, and that is in Fish Ponds, and that will be talking about what is happening on that site that we just talked about, the 12 houses. So those two things, come along to the tour of the Ashville site at 10 o'clock, and then you can make your way across to Fish Ponds and have a look at what's happening up there. And if you're interested in the Community Land Trust, then you can sign up and maybe one of the homes could be yours.
Okay, so the Community Land Trust is a membership organisation. If people are interested, they can find that online. But just remind us again of your Ecomotive website if people are interested in the tour of Ashley Vale, and the phone number, Jackson.
Yeah, so the our website is ecomotive.org. That's ecomotive.org. And the phone number is 0117 924 1263.
Okay, Jackson Moulding from Ecomotive, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
And I'm joined on the phone now from Sweden by Chris Bollin. Hi, Chris. Welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony. Nice to be with you.
Now, give us an idea, could you, about how you first met Jim Tucker, because that's who we're talking about today. He's a reporter from American Free Press who died on Friday, sadly. But I know you and I met up with him and you worked quite a lot with him, and I met the pair of you in Brussels, didn't we? Tell us how you first met Jim and how, what it was like working with him when you first met him.
Yeah, sure. My first job as a journalist was with Jim Tucker. I had joined the newspaper. It was a spotlight at that time. And Jim Tucker, my first assignment was to be the photographer for the Bilderberg confab or conference, whatever you want to call it, that was happening in Genval, just outside of Brussels.
So that was the first time you worked with him, Chris. Interesting, because that was the first time I'd met him.
Yeah, that was the first time, and it was a very interesting time. We weren't quite sure. He wasn't quite sure on the location of the Bilderberg meeting, but we pretty much had it sussed out that it was at this specific hotel. So I went and stayed the night before in the hotel and scouted around inside the hotel, and I found signs that said steering committee and things like that. And I called back to Jim in Brussels, I think it was, and I told him for sure this is the place. And it was a very interesting conference because I was working for the first time as like a paparazzo, a photographer who was getting these pictures of these people who really didn't want to be photographed. And one of my best pictures from that meeting was of George Soros speaking off to the side with Carl Bildt, the current foreign minister of Sweden, who was at that time or had been the special envoy to the Balkans.
Yeah, so tell us a bit about Bilderberg, Chris, because Jim really made this his life's work, I guess, so certainly the last 10 years of his life. And even before that, he was doggedly investigating where they were meeting, tracking them down, writing about them, and even had a conversation with the British Prime Minister, former British Prime Minister at the time, Margaret Thatcher, about Bilderberg, her saying that she was very proud to have been denounced by this organisation. So who are they?
Yeah, it goes back a long way with Jim Tucker. He's been following them since, I think, the 80s or the 70s even. You know, it's this group of, there's a steering committee or a group of people who are regulars, people who are like inducted members to the cult or to the group. These are, of course, people like David Rockefeller and Henry Kissinger, who are at the top. And then there's a cadre of people who are fast members. And then they have this, revolving members, people who come in for a meeting at a particular year, and you know, these are basically, I would call them consensus forming meetings. That's pretty much what I understand, is that these big shots from, you know, both sides of the ocean, from the big guys in NATO, the Kissingers and the Rockefellers of the world, they then impose or coax their worldview and the plan for the next 12 months onto this very select group of several hundred men from high positions in the United States and across Europe and around the world. And, of course, what Jim Tucker found so reprehensible about the Bilderberg meeting was that elected members of the U.S. Congress and American politicians and people of that, you know, public officials in the United States were attending these meetings at public expense. And these are truly the insider meetings. You know, if there's any insider group, it would be the Bilderbergers. So that, you know, these people, when they know what's going to happen in the following year, they know which way to sell stocks. They know what things to hedge and what decisions to make. It's really the insider club, you know, of the world.
But certainly the Western world and the NATO countries. But I mean, how did Jim? Because he was very famous for getting leaks from these conferences, and also for leaking the venue beforehand. Because the last thing in the world that the Bilderbergers want is publicity. And Jim was actually able to make sure that people knew where and when they were about to meet, or at least had a very good guess. So how did he get this these leaked information? Maybe you can't tell us all about it, but this was one of the most important jobs Jim was doing. He was doing some real investigative journalism, which is so sadly lacking in the mainstream media in the Western world.
Yeah, there aren't very many journalists like Jim Tucker anymore. He was he's an old school journalist, and he did, you know, research the old fashioned way, calling people up. Going to places where these people are likely to meet, talking to people, going to the Washington National Press Club, for example, and through the network of people and telephone calls, he was always able to determine to find the location. And this is done, you know, the old fashioned way, talking to people. And you know, there are no journalists, there are no investigative journalists anymore, and especially not like Jim Tucker.
Okay, so what about when it came to the meeting itself? Because this is a completely sealed off meeting, locked down. How on earth can you get leaks out from there, Chris?
Well, leaks, once the meeting has begun, you know, I was with him in France and Sweden and in Belgium. You know, at that point, we would try to talk to people who were insiders. Sometimes people who worked in the hotel, for example, would you know, give us a list they had found in the trash basket or something. Remember, there was some lists, I think it was Sweden, they were printed on red paper. They were, you know, like, so that the point of printing them on red paper is that they can't be Xeroxed. I think in Sweden we got the whole list of people who attended, and you know, it's the old fashioned way, getting people who are on the inside, like a person who works there, or who will give you some information. It's not that hard.
Okay, fascinating. So, now Jim is not around, he's not with us anymore. Do you think that's going to make a difference to whether these meetings are covered at all in the world?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. He's the dean of Bilderberg Studies. I don't see anybody that's going to carry it further it was something that, that Jim Tucker had devoted his a lot of his career to. And there is nobody who understands the group as well as he does, nor I don't see anybody that, that would pick up the ball. I don't see how it's going, you know, Bilderberg is probably, the Bilderberg people are probably very happy that Jim Tucker is no longer with us because they will be getting a free ride now.
But why does the big networks like NBC, the BBC, you know, the national state media we have in Europe, and the national newspapers, things like the New York Times, you know, why do these people not cover these meetings? Because, I mean, you've got the richest and most powerful people in the Western world, including royalty. You know, you've got David Rockefeller, who's basically like a giant country of his of himself, if you look at his wealth. You know, when they're all getting together, you'd have thought that the mainstream press, you know, and at least the public service media like the BBC would take an interest.
Well, Tony, you know from having been at some of these conferences that these the people who own these media outlets are often in attendance. They are often invited. Editors and very high-level journalists and people who own the media are Bilderberg attendees. and they have taken this the same oath that everybody else has taken, this kind of oath of omerta, not to talk about it. So it's part of the secrecy of life in modern Western world that, that, you know, people are allowed to conspire. The highest level people in our governments are allowed to conspire behind closed doors, and the media won't even talk about it. Jim Tucker used to say that if this was a collection of basketball players or football players or movie stars, anybody else, it would be reported on the front page news. But because these are the people who run our countries and run our media, it is absolutely not discussed at all.
Now, you just used the term almuerta, which is something that's used by the mafia, basically. You've got to keep your mouth shut, and this is a mafia term. Would you consider the Bilderberg in the same bracket?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. My experience there, you were probably, I think you were there in Belgium. After I took that photograph, they had a break on the second day, first day, second day. I think it was the second day of the convention. They came out for a breath of fresh air on this little lake, and they weren't really expecting to have very many journalists out there, and there weren't very many, you know. There was a lot of local people who wanted to see what was going on there. That was it. So I was clicking pictures of these guys that came out, and these are the heads, these are the former heads of the CIA and U.S. government and senators and what have you. And when I saw Carl Bildt come out with George Soros, I walked along with them, took some pictures, and I even ventured a question or two to Mr. Carl Bildt because, you know, I know something about what's going on with him. And then there were some Belgian thugs, the security, so-called security for the Bilderberg Conference. Then they started following me and chasing me, and they forced me to retreat into a nearby restaurant. And then they waited outside, and I had to escape from that place and run to the train station and get on a train back to Brussels because, they use mafia tactics. They don't want people talking about them or photographing them, and that's the kind of that's the game they're playing. It is a mafia.
Okay, Chris, thanks very much.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
And I'm joined now by Ricky Canty from Cardiff. Hi, Ricky. Welcome to Dialect.
Hello there.
Now, you've taken the trouble to take a trip right across. It's actually not that far, really, is it, Newport and Cardiff from here? But why have you come?
To talk about an illegal bankruptcy, 4th of July 2000.
Was it your house, your business? What happened?
Well, a building firm and a firm of solicitors fraudulently made a claim for costs against myself and my mother.
Well, why do you say fraudulently?
Because we didn't owe them any money.
But surely that would have been immediately thrown out of court?
Well, no, because the judge was friendly with the building company and the solicitors company and said that we did owe them money.
Just tell us how you first found out about it all then.
Well, it was diabolical, really, when somebody said that you owed £84,000 and your mother also owed £84,000 when you didn't owe a shilling. In fact, the creditors in the bankruptcy, i.e. the people that put the fraudulent claims against us, actually owed us money.
You knew these people beforehand?
Yes, yes.
What were they saying that you were supposed to owe them for? And what?
For court costs. But the problem was that all the court hearings that I attended, we actually won and we were awarded the costs. That's how I know that the claims that they put in against us were fraudulent.
Do you have any proof of that?
Yeah, I got all the cost orders.
What has this experience taught you about the justice system?
Well, it's totally corrupt and totally bent.
Well, surely not totally. I mean, surely some cases are okay, aren't they?
No. No. How can somebody say that you owe £160,000 when you don't owe a shilling? And the judge say that you do owe the money.
The obvious thing to do in that sort of situation, Ricky, is to appeal.
I appealed. I've been appealing since the 4th of July 2000.
And surely you're only allowed to appeal it once, aren't you?
Not if they jail you in between. I mean, I've been to jail 3 or 4 times for contempt of court, just for speaking the truth. The claims against us were fraudulent.
Your situation, how did it change? What were you doing before this case and what were you doing after?
Well, I was a car dealer at the time when it first started, but they skint me out. They stole everything I ever owned. They stole everything my mother worked for, everything my father worked for and everything I worked for. They stole the property. I was living on the roof of my property for 28 months. On top of the roof.
Living on the roof? What? Yeah. Where and what was that
in
like?
In Barry. Well, it was just like camping, but it was on the roof. Well, to guard my property against PricewaterhouseCoopers, one of the biggest firms in the world.
How were they involved in all this then?
Well, they were the alleged trustees in the bankruptcy.
How did you survive living on the roof?
Well, my sister and all the neighbours used to give me food and all that.
Did you have absolutely no money at all at that point?
Nothing.
How long were you up there?
28 months. Well, in between, they gave me the 6 months jail for contempt of court, for not vacating the property.
Okay, and what do you put all this down to? You think it's everything is corrupt? I mean, it's going to taint your view of the entire legal system, isn't it? But, I mean, surely, this has just happened to you. Whether it's fraudulent or not, we don't know, but certainly it's what you're saying.
No, I've had numerous people ring me up while I was on the roof saying that they'd done this and they'd done that and they'd done this and done that. You know, it's all over the country, Scotland, everywhere.
So how does this corruption actually work then?
Well, it's Freemasons, Masonic Mafia.
Freemasonry?
Yeah.
So have you any evidence that the people involved in this were Freemasons?
Well, obviously they were Freemasons, otherwise they couldn't do what they'd done to me. How can a judge go against the law that's written in the books, which the judges wrote? You can't go against the bankruptcy rules, but they did, in my case.
You're obviously not living on the roof anymore, Ricky.
Shared accommodation from the Huggard Centre in Cardiff.
What happened to you after you had to leave the roof? You were jailed.
Well, PricewaterhouseCoopers sent a couple of gangsters in, ripped me off the roof and put me in hospital. Well, I heard it was a couple of cage fighters. Two come through the roof and one come up a ladder. And there was two more inside the house. They put me in hospital.
Well, obviously you did end up in hospital, Ricky, but that is just, I would like to stress, just an allegation that PricewaterhouseCoopers were behind it. Anyway, you're here for a specific purpose, which is to talk about this bankruptcy case, Ricky.
It's a totally illegal bankruptcy of Mrs. Rita Grace Canty and myself on the 4th of July 2000 in the Cardiff Civil Justice Centre.
I mean, surely that's, you know, for you to be assaulted by these people, that is a crime in itself.
Yeah, but I was the one that got arrested after I'd come out of hospital. And then I was banned from Batty because I couldn't go back to Batty. I had nowhere to live. They were going to put me over the wall, lock me up, put me in jail. But a friend of mine said that I could stay with him in Cardiff. Then I had to go to the Huggard Centre and they found me some accommodation, you know, shared accommodation. Like I say, how can a judge go against the Law of Properties Act 1925, Section 40, or the Insolvency Act 1986 and Insolvency Rules 1986 with impunity if it's not the Masonic Mafia that's doing it?
How have you, you know, taken this back to the court to try and get justice?
I've been appealing since the 4th of July 2000.
Right, is that just one appeal or several appeals?
Oh, 10 appeals, yeah. In the end, they put what they call a grape versus loam order against me, which means that I'm precluded from making any applications whatsoever throughout the country or the European Court in Strasbourg or anywhere. But that was totally illegal as well, because the Secretary of State has got to issue that, and they didn't. It was a barrister from PricewaterhouseCoopers, a judge called Mr. Justice Neuberger, and he's the main man now in the Supreme Court in London.
So what were your thoughts about how to sort this sort of situation out?
Well, all I want is a bit of justice. I'm entitled to it. My father fought in a war for this country, and they treated myself and my mother this way is unbelievable. Absolutely incredible.
And now, have you had any support in Cardiff from friends, other people?
Well, I've had tons of support, but you can't do anything against the Masonic Mafia.
Okay, Ricky, what message have you got for the listeners out there about how to avoid the sort of sticky mess you've got yourself into there?
Well, don't trust any lawyers.
But, I mean, how do you get justice in that case?
Well, do it yourself, a litigant in person.
And what is a litigant in person?
It's just a person that defends or protects himself in the courts.
Right, so the idea being that, to a certain extent, when you're going into a court process, you're entering a bit of an unknown world, and the obvious thing to do is to hire somebody to help you through that world, obviously a solicitor, but you're saying that maybe the best thing is just to go in and...
Do it yourself, yeah.
Yeah, how has that helped you, though?
Well, I won every court case that I took on against barristers and QCs and all that in the High Court in London, the Appeal Court. There was QCs against me that I won against, and I'm a litigant in person, but they didn't want to pay me the costs. So that's why they illegally made myself and my mother bankrupts, so they didn't have to pay us the money that they owed us.
And what's you and your mum's situation now?
Well, my mother's dead. They killed my mother, or they helped her on her way.
And what about you?
Well, they're trying to kill me, or I've been doing it for a long time, so nobody's, like I say, none of these Masons are helping me.
So can't you just drop this and move on into another line of business?
Well, would you? Are you lucky enough to still have your mother alive? Well, if I said you owed me 84,000 quid, and your mother owed me 84,000 quid, and I had you and your mother chucked out on the streets when you didn't owe me a shilling, would you let it drop?
Ricky Canty, thanks very much for joining us on
Dialect. Thank you.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Well, we're joined by Paul Fernie, who's been taking us through the solar system. We started with Mercury, Venus, and now...
It's Earth.
Planet Earth. Now, have you got... 3 or 4 hours to tell us about Earth?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's our home planet. It's the only planet known in the universe to harbour life. It occupies what astronomers call the Goldilocks zone of the solar system, so it's not too hot and not too cold.
But I mean, if we were sort of different creatures, we might be made of asbestos and we might like the heat. So who are they to say where life is best to grow up, Paul?
Indeed, Tony. I mean, obviously, there's various options that haven't been explored yet for basis for life forms. So, yeah, I mean, but as it stands, we're pretty much water-based creatures and we like the general conditions that Earth provides us with.
I thought you were going to say alcohol-based. No, water-based. Anyway, tell us a bit about Earth. What makes Earth different other than the fact that we've got life on here? Because that's the most obvious thing, isn't it?
Okay, so just some sort of, vital statistics. Average distance from the Sun is 92,955,820 miles.
That's 93 million miles,
well,
to you and I.
To you and I. It's one astronomical unit, which is a rather convenient measure. Its diameter is 7,926 miles at the equator. Takes 23 hours and 56 minutes to spin on its axis, so a day. And the orbit takes 365 days and 6 hours.
Now, if I was travelling on a first bus down Church Road, doing about the average of, 3 miles an hour or something, how long would it take me to get to the Sun from here?
Thank you, Tony. Give me till next week and I'll answer that one for you.
Okay. Sorry, that was a little bit of a curveball there. But it's a long way to the Sun, isn't it? But we're at the perfect distance, and I think that's the key thing, isn't it? Just about right for temperature. And, of course, it gets a little bit hotter than we like and a bit colder than we like, but average is just about perfect.
Yeah, average is just about perfect. I mean, the minimum temperature recorded on Earth is minus 88 degrees C, and the maximum temperature is plus 57 degrees C. Also, I mean, just for some other information, the speed of rotation of the Earth. So if you're standing still on the equator, you're actually being propelled at 1,040 miles an hour, because that's the speed at
Hang on. 1,000 miles an hour. That's faster than the speed of sound. So you're breaking the sound barrier. But
effectively, yes. But obviously, this is a momentum spin, so you're not actually as such.
Ah, so all of the... It's not as if you're going through the air, because all the air is moving at the same speed
as everything's moving together. So the atmosphere and everything is moving together, but the Earth itself spins at the equator at 1,040 miles an hour. If you stood on the North Pole or the South Pole, you would actually take a whole day to do one rotation. You'd only you'd spin very slowly.
Right,
it changes
according.
I believe I read some time ago that in England the actual speed of rotation is about 948 miles an hour, because obviously because it's a sphere, it doesn't all.
Well, if you're standing in the bus stop listening to this,
if you're standing at the bus stop, you're moving a lot faster.
You're going much quicker
stuck
than
in
the
traffic,
buses.
Yeah, if you're stuck in traffic, you're moving at a fair old whack.
950 miles an hour in Britain, and if you go down to the equator in Africa, you're going at about 1,400 miles an hour.
1,040. Yeah.
Okay. So, how far is it right the way? What's the circumference of the Earth around the equator?
24,500 miles
all the way around.
Yeah, all the way around. Yeah. Okay. Again, I mean, obviously, you know, we sort of, like you say, you sort of, because of gravity and stuff, we stand and we think, oh, we're standing still. But actually, you've got the speed of rotation, then you've got the speed that the Earth travels in its orbit, which, if I remember from memory, is about 64,000 miles an hour.
Crikey.
So it's traveling. So the Earth's traveling through space at 64,000 miles an hour. So actually, when you're standing still, you're actually moving a fair old pace.
You're doing all sorts of... You're 1,000 miles in one direction, 64,000 in the other.
Yeah.
So next time you're bored, waiting for the bus, you can remember that. Now, what about this... see, the other thing about is our atmosphere, which is the key thing, which allows us to breathe and all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
Why is the sky blue?
Right, the sky is blue is due to Rayleigh scattering, which is the absorption of different wavelengths of light. Light travels in waves, and different coloured light has different wavelengths. Basically, blue is a short wavelength, so it is absorbed more often than the longer wavelengths like red, orange, yellow. Now, what happens is... the Earth's atmosphere is made up of 78% nitrogen, 20% oxygen, and then a few other bits and pieces make up the other couple of percent. And basically, because of these gases, they absorb the short wavelength blue light. And basically, what happens is when the gas particles absorb it, it's then radiated off at a later time. And basically, so when you look in the sky when in daylight, it's blue because all this blue light is being re-radiated by the gas particles. So that's why we have a blue sky.
I suppose that's why the sea's blue, because it just reflects the blue sky.
Yes, I would believe so.
I'm guessing here.
I'd have to take advice on that.
The sea's green.
The sea's green. The sea's various colours. But also, it's interesting. I actually saw a photo, and you can go online and see these photos. The Cassini craft, which went to Saturn a few years ago, actually, when it was at Saturn, looked back and took a photo of Earth, and it appears as this tiny blue gem. And it is known that if from any other planet in the solar system, Earth would be the brightest object because the sea reflects all of the light.
Now, some people don't necessarily want to stay on the Earth, do they? The idea is that they want to go, get in rocket ships and go off to the moon, this kind of thing. Now, I remember hearing in the news the other week about some Dutch guy who's trying to get money off people to leave the planet Earth. Well, what's the purpose of that? And apparently they're not going to come back either.
Yeah, it's a one-way ticket that they're offering with various sort of charges based on the gross national income of the country that you live in. Anything from $5 to $78 is the charge for application. The purpose of it, I'm not really sure. I think it's more of a publicity stunt than anything else.
Not a pyramid selling scheme. Yeah.
Well, it could be that as well. What pyramids they're selling, though, I really don't know. But one-way trip to Mars, 24 people. I can't see the enjoyment in myself. I mean, I struggle around crowds of people, but can you imagine spending 60 years of your life with the same 23 people?
And then not coming back to Earth. I mean, what's the point, really? I mean, surely if they could get out there, and I mean, it's going to be really boring most of the time.
Yeah,
not a lot to see.
Not a lot to see up there. Obviously, you can't really go for a wander when you get bored. because of the atmosphere not being able to support life.
This is very unscientific, but I would recommend people get a telescope instead.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, we have the technology, we have, you know, physically humans can take it, but psychologically I think we're still a bit beyond that. And the reason why we haven't, you know, done manned missions to Mars up to this point is purely because of getting back, because you have to take all the fuel with you, or you have to produce the fuel once you're there to get back. Yeah, it's
but can't you buy it from the Martians?
No? Well, you know, whether there's a Texaco station up there, I don't know. Other petrol
well,
stations
they're pretty
are
much
available.
Everywhere Texaco, aren't they?
Yeah.
Okay, so one of the things that I've been wanting to ask you for a while, and it's Earth is the obvious place to ask you, is, I mean, when we were, I can remember as a youngster in the 60s and the 70s, there was a massive thing about, you know, the race to the stars, and it's all just starting. It's sort of, we had the Apollo missions and all that, and it kind of conked out. What happened?
Yeah, I think, again, it's down to sort of technology. I mean, you know, they meant, obviously rocket motors were developed, and they found that, you know, they were sufficient to get us a certain distance. But because, the you know, we think of distance in miles, as I've spoken, you know, many times on the show, you know, when you start going into space, you're talking millions of miles often to another object, and it's time. And, you know, unfortunately, until we come up with some sort of Einstein type speed of light travel, a lot of stuff out there is just too far away. I mean, the Pioneer craft and the Voyager craft, which were sent up back in the 70s, you know, they're only just reaching the edge of the solar system, you know, 30 years on. You know, there's huge distances involved. Plus, there's the whole life support issue. I mean, you know, are you going to rely on an air conditioning unit to support you for the rest of your life? You know,
what about travel close to the speed of light, though? Because that would make it. I mean, apparently, according to physicists, you can't go faster than the speed of light, but you could surely get quite close to it, and that would make it a bit quicker to get to Pluto, even if it isn't that much of a hospitable place.
Yeah, it's. I mean, speed of light's constant; it never changes, so you can't go faster than the speed of light. In all fairness, the best place to look for any ideas of where we may be able to go with this is probably Star Trek and warp speed. I think that's the one they're looking at as being most viable.
Come on. Star Trek.
No, seriously. I mean, come on, Star Trek had iPads well before Apple invented them.
Well, that's true. Okay, so what is warp speed, and if there is any real reality to it?
Warp speed is the warping of space. So basically, you with the use of their engines, I'm not going to go deeply into the technology, but the use of the engine, basically it warps space, so it cramps space up in front of the ship so that it can travel through far more space than it actually is travelling through, if you like. So, I say, it's been a long time since I read the technical manual to
I could do with that sometimes on the way down the M4.
Yeah, know. Absolutely. I think we could all do with it sometimes.
Especially, you know, when there's someone in the fast lane who's doing one of those fast lane fascist things, you think, oh, it'd be quite nice to go zip past them and put the warp on, you know.
Yeah, put warp drive on, fire up the nacelle.
The fast lane fascist. Have you ever come across, have you ever come across them?
Yeah, I used to be one.
It was you. All right, Paul, well, we've come down to Earth with a bang there. Next week, Mars.
Next week, Mars.
Okay.
Plenty to talk about.
Thanks very much, Paul Fernie.
Thanks. BCFM 93.2.
Bristol is our community. Time for Jeff Sparks and the What's On Guide. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Tony. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 3rd of May, DJ Don Letts will be performing with support from Muff Said and Retro Junk at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £7 in advance, doors open at 7:30 PM. Also on 3rd of May, Beholder will be performing with support from Bull Riff Stampede and Darkening Suns at the Croft in Stokescroft, Bristol. Tickets are £6 in advance and doors open at 8 PM. On to Song of the Week, and I present Riot Noise. This group formed in Bristol in 2009 and to date have released 2 EPs and a debut album which will be released on June 3rd, 2013. This is from the forthcoming album, which is titled Stand for Something, and is the song Guidance. When you heard me, I owe was White Noise with Guidance from the forthcoming studio album Stand For Something. To download Guidance for free, go to riotnoise.bandcamp.com. Moving into Saturday 4th of May, Dr. Chocolate, who are one of the Southwest premier function bands, will be performing at the Salt House in Clevedon. Entry is free and the gig starts at 9 p.m. Finally, on Saturday 4th of May, the Guns N' Roses Experience will be performing at the Cheese and Grain in Market Yard, Froome. Tickets are £12 in advance and doors open at 8 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 o'clock every Friday afternoon. And if you're listening online, you can find us at dialectradio.co.uk. And that's where you can go to get onto our email list and our RSS feed. dialectradio.co.uk. Dialect's a Bristol Radio Co-op production and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. You'll find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. As promised, here's the number again for Bristol Bully Watch Helpline. That's 01454 318 753. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye.
the rocket gets on his back to make a turn before he takes his leave. Only anyone by such corner, just like it used to be. And as he flies, tears in